From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Farah Jasmine Griffin of Columbia University and Carla Kaplan of Northeastern University are both fellows at the New York Public Library's Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, and they join me now to discuss their research into the role women, both black and white, played in the Harlem Renaissance and the time that followed. I'm very pleased to welcome them to my show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Farah, most people probably think of the 20s and Langston Hughes when they think of the Harlem Renaissance. Are the artists that you focused on from the 30s and 40s part of the Harlem Renaissance?
Actually, they probably are not. The women that I'm most interested in build upon a lot of the things that happened in the Harlem Renaissance, but they really see themselves as modern women of the 40s.
Was the Harlem Renaissance, I can only think of one woman who we even associate with it, was it largely a male endeavor, or did they have to wait until after the Harlem Renaissance kind of died out before they established themselves?
Actually, no. The Harlem Renaissance itself had many women who were contributors to it. Jessie Fawcett, Nella Larsen, a number of women poets. But it isn't until the 1940s that black women, in particular, begin to get the kind of attention for their work that men had been receiving a little bit earlier.
With the exception of Zora Neale Hurston.
With the exception of Hurston, right, yeah. Who also, you know, gets attention then, but certainly gets more attention thanks to my colleague and other people like her much later on.
Well, you've written a book about Billie Holiday. Was she an active participant?
She was very important to the women in the 1940s. She, by the World War II, she was an absolute star and was someone that most of the women, particularly in entertainment, certainly looked up to. I would say she was a pioneer and really kind of bridges that gap between the Harlem Renaissance and the later period.
Carla, you've been working on a project called Miss Anne in Harlem, the White Women of the Black Renaissance. Are you making a distinction here? Is the Black Renaissance distinct from the Harlem Renaissance?
The terms are usually used more or less synonymously. Part of the point of that title, the Black Renaissance and the Harlem Renaissance, the Black Renaissance is often used to designate the fact that this did not just happen in Harlem, that there was a Black Renaissance going on at the same time in Chicago and in Washington, D.C. and in Philly. What I'm really interested in this story is the story of a group that it really is a race-crossing story, and I'm fascinated by this group of white women who tried to do what was then an almost unthinkable thing and essentially volunteer for blackness. They sort of put up their hands and said, us too, we want to join.
For political reasons, do you think?
Some of them for political reasons. Part of what I'm interested in telling this story is the panoply of reasons that motivated these women to do what they did. And again, what they did in the time was really unthinkable. More, I think, than we can wrap our minds around now. It was a very risky thing politically and physically and emotionally to try to survive with dignity as a black woman during the 1920s. And we know now even to be suspected of being black in the 1920s was to risk being subjected to humiliation. These women say, we want that. It's an amazing choice.
But they weren't trying to pass. Well, there's a famous memoir about a man whose mother told her she was Jewish, but she told him that she was black. Passing was a big concern. And in fact, Nella Larsen's novel Passing explores the complex lives of black women who passed for white during this time period.
Indeed. I just finished doing a Norton Critical Edition of Passing. But I do in this story have some stories of white women who actually were passing for black. That way in which people can fall in love with an identity not seen as theirs can lead even to passing, even to trying to cross over. In other ways, they were symbolically passing. Many of them were trying to cross-identify.
Who was the Miss Anne that is referred to in your title?
Miss Anne is a phrase that actually remains current in black communities across the nation and had strong currency throughout the 20s. It's the female equivalent of the phrase Mr. Charlie. And it was black slang as a generally derisive term for any white woman. So that's what I'm looking at.
Farah, your research is called Harlem Nocturne, Black Women Artists in New York, 1938-1948. And as you pointed out earlier, this is kind of at the end of the Harlem Renaissance, the next phase covering World War II and its aftermath.
Absolutely.
And then changes in American society as well. So how much of that is reflected in the work of the women you're looking at?
Well, it's absolutely reflected in their work. They all are, I'm looking across fields at people who are composers and dancers and novelists, the novelist Anne Petrie in particular. And I think what we see, the way that their work really is a evidence of the times that they're living in, is that they're also very politically engaged. They're very committed to this notion of making the United States a democracy and very committed to their right to dissent. They don't see that as not being patriotic, but I think they claim the United States in the ways that earlier generations did not.
You mentioned Anne Petrie.
Mm-hmm.
I have a dim recollection of her as being famous at one point. Now,
right.
What's happened to writers like her? Have they kind of been lost? Are you involved in some kind of reclamation project?
Well, I think one of the things that I found so interesting when I first started this project in the 1940s is that I assumed that most of these women did not get a great deal of attention. But you're absolutely right. Petrie was a literary celebrity in the 1940s. Her book sold a million copies. She was reviewed in the New York Times, and this was true of all of the women about whom I write. Mary Lou Williams, Pearl Primus, was the darling of John Martin.
She was the dancer. Mary Lou Williams, the great pianist.
Right. So they really did get a great deal of attention in the 40s, but I think for a number of reasons, some of them political, they kind of fall out of sight following the 40s, and it's in the late 70s, early 80s, with the kind of emergence of black studies, women's studies, that we start to see attention to them again. So Petrie actually experiences another blip of fame just before her death in 97. But from the mid-40s on through the 80s, certainly we lose sight of her.
So why do you think male voices have dominated this whole period, Harlem Renaissance and its aftermath?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that certainly for the period that I'm talking about, one, it's just American cultural history for the most part in terms of what gets documented and what gets recorded has tended to focus on men. And so there have been these projects of reclamation. And then some of the men were very, they shed big shadows during the period that I'm writing about. We're talking about Paul Robeson, Charlie Parker, Richard Wright. So those were big, big figures, but they were most often accompanied by these women as well.
Now, Carla, the white women who were involved in the Black Renaissance, did they have certain advantages because they were white? Were they able to do things that black women who probably were just as involved couldn't do?
Absolutely. And I think that was part of what drew some of these women to Harlem. I'm looking at two generations of women, a younger generation of women who tended to be involved in the parties, socializing, had black lovers, married black men, maybe passed, and an older generation who were actually using being in black Harlem to escape the kinds of choices available for white wealthy women, to put themselves in a situation where they had a very peculiar status and nobody could really tell them what to do. And so it's a very different story than you would find of the black women of this period.
My guests are Carla Kaplan of Northeastern University and Farah Jasmine Griffin of Columbia University, who are also working just recently became fellows at the New York Public Library's Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, and they're working on projects in Farrah Griffin's case, Harlem Nocturne, Black Women Artists in New York, 1938 to 1948, and in Carla Kaplan's case, Miss Anne in Harlem, the White Women of the Black Renaissance. We mentioned earlier Zora Neale Hurston. Carla, your most recent book was Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters. Why do you think she has remained a name that people recognize? Was she better than the other women?
She was certainly far and away the most productive of the women writers we associate with the Harlem Renaissance. Just wrote an enormous number of novels and anthropology, and as we now know, plays, and got them onto Broadway and did radio appearances. I do think that there tends to be, in popular imagination and literary studies, fads. And, you know, we are in a kind of Zora Neale Hurston moment. But also I think people are finally able to look at the full range of what she did, and she really is worthy of the attention she's getting now.
But she's also a controversial figure.
Very much so.
Richard Wright attacks her, it's not because of some male thing. It's because he disagreed with her on some of her ideas, which still strike us as odd.
It's very much a male thing. When Richard Wright says in his famous review of her that her novel, The Rise We're Watching God, had no theme, no message, no thought, what he's missing is this is one of the most feminist novels of the 20th century, one of the most radically feminist novels of the 20th century. And for him to say it has no theme, he has to somehow not hear that piece.
Oh, I'm more caught up in the controversial statement she made about slavery.
Yes. And she was very controversial. She was someone...
She was pro-segregation.
Not at all. She was actually very, very anti-segregation. What she was also so anti-patronization of any kind that the idea of laws around segregation and integration on either side seemed to her insane. Her view was, who could not want me in the room? This makes no sense. How could anybody want to legislate me out? And she's often misunderstood. That's partly her own fault, but she's often misunderstood as being pro-segregation.
But also, we tend to judge people based on the ideas of any time. And I wonder, Farrah, will the same thing happen with you when you discovered some of these people who probably did wonderful things and also said some things that might be considered politically incorrect today?
Well, I think that, they would certainly be considered politically incorrect today, but I think for very complicated reasons. One of the reasons why each of them falls out of favor is that they, well, and this is not as true of Mary Lou Williams, but in some ways, is that they are all associated with a kind of popular front politics. And when we get the rise of the Cold War, we get McCarthyism, that people begin to shut up and, you know, and not express dissent in the way that they felt they could.
In the case of Mary Lou Williams, she became famous as a woman who could play better than men, which today we might consider to be an unacceptable description. But then later in her life, achieved a different kind of fame because she became a Catholic convert who only wrote music that was involved with the church.
Right. And she never, though, she never gave up her commitment to Black music. She just thought that Black music had something to bring to the music of the Catholic Church. She became a fierce educator in the history of Black musics and always a defender of jazz and the progress of jazz.
In the case of Billie Holiday, she seems to be an incredibly mysterious person. In the case of Zora Neale Hurston, she also seems to be a mysterious person. Is that somehow connected to this time? Or is it just these two women?
It's a very interesting question.
There's a whole business about life and identity with them.
I do think, in part, I'll just speak for myself, I have become fascinated with women who seem mysterious now because when they lived, there was no language for understanding what they were trying to do. It's true of all the white women I'm looking at. There was really no language for understanding their cultural crossing as women in the time. And for Hurston, there was really no language for a profoundly culturally conservative radical feminist. She was doing something that was a self-invention.
And now we have Andrew Sullivan.
And now, oh goodness, Hurston and Sullivan, there we go.
I think that the book is yet to be written about black women and notions of mystery and secrecy. And I think in many ways it's a very self-protective device that's a legacy of slavery in some ways. And certainly we can talk about Hurston, mm-hmm. we can talk about Billie Holiday, but, you know, we could find this out about many women.
Well, it might be interesting to develop a Harlem Renaissance and post-Renaissance canon, find out, because I'm sure there are any number of wonderful things to be rediscovered, and Petrie just being one of them.
Right.
Anybody doing something like that?
Well, I think that there are people who are now looking at a number of people have written on women of the Harlem Renaissance, the black women of the Harlem Renaissance, and now the 1940s are finally beginning to receive some of the attention they deserve. They've been sort of absent on our timeline, but they're so important that I think we will start hearing more about the women of that period.
I want to thank you both so much. Farah Jasmine Griffin of Columbia University, Carla Kaplan of Northeastern University. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.